This is Deanna Spingola. It is Thursday, July 26, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Veronica Clark. Her websites are veraiconapublishers.org and youtube.com/veraicona100. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. How are you?
I'm very good.
All right. Great.
Yes.
Real quick, I just wanted to thank all those who have recently purchased books, been helping out a lot, making possible the next publication. And I'm almost done with the first edit of this thing. It's Albion and Zion United. It's going to be explosive. So this is straight from the Third Reich, primary document, translated by Wilfried Heinck. I'm doing a little bit of translating, but mostly editing so that it reads well in English. And basically what this is it's the National Socialist perspective on the Palestinian state being turned into a Jewish state and how the Germans are opposed to that. And that England was, in fact, behind a great deal of illegal secret immigration of Jews into Palestine with the help of prominent Jewish leaders, including that Judge Brandeis in the United States.
Right.
The Rothschilds, the Samuels, they all played a role. So this will be, I think, the really definitive answer to anyone who claims that Hitler was the founder of Israel. This cannot be refuted.
And when will that be available?
That's coming January 2013.
We have to wait that long?
Yes. Because I'm putting a lot of other information with it. Part of that is going to be the following. Will found this on the non-aggression pact between Germany and Poland, which we had asked last week, what happened to that? Because it is mentioned in that After the Battle article on Gleiwitz. Here's what he found, and this is in a German language book, so we don't get this in English. Following the signing of the pact on January 26, 1934, the relationship between Berlin and Warsaw was relatively good. On October 24th, 1938, now this is around the time of the repatriation of the Jutsis to Poland, because we had that little visa problem, Ribbentrop had a long talk with the Polish emissary Lipski, with Ribbentrop proposing that remaining conflicts should be resolved. This is probably being one of them, that visa thing. He suggested also that Danzig should become part of the Reich. Wilf writes, we need to remember that Danzig was never given to Poland, but was administered by the League of Nations, allegedly, and a road rail link be established between Pomerania and East Prussia. In return, Poland was to be granted special economic considerations in Danzig, and her borders be guaranteed for 25 years by the Reich. So this is an extremely generous proposal by Hitler. Even offered to defend Poland if the Soviet Union ever, you know, violated their borders, that the Reich would come to Poland's aid. Lipski promised to convey this to his boss, Foreign Secretary Colonel Joseph Beck. In January 1939, Beck visited Germany, met Hitler at Berchtesgaden on the 5th. Hitler referred to the relations between Poland and Germany, but stressed that the Danzig and Link question should be settled. Beck was accommodating, but pointed out that the Danzig issue was not so easy to settle, as Polish public opinion was against a return to Germany. I thought that was a little interesting. Following that meeting, the Polish press increased its German bashing. So we need to ask who was behind the Polish press. I think we can pretty much rest assured it was mostly communist and liberal,
right,
and pro-Jewish. So that explains that. That therein explains why public opinion was against giving Danzig back to Germany and being unreasonable. When German troops entered what was left of Czechoslovakia, which was a French satellite, according to some historians, really literally de facto French satellite, Poland ordered a partial mobilization in the Danzig territory, and Lipski told Ribbentrop on March 26th that a return of Danzig would mean war with Germany. Following this, Hitler signed on April 3rd instructions regarding Case White. And of course, Case White wasn't actually set into motion until May. So that's that. I'm going to skip over most of what he wrote here because it's not really relevant to what we're talking about. But we should remember that Hitler did not protest when Poland grabbed chunks from what used to be Czechoslovakia. They went in there too when Germany did, and yet we only hear about the German grabbing of Czechoslovakia. And then Annelies von Ribbentrop wrote the following, and this is really important. She wrote a book in the German language only, unfortunately, about kind of the traitors and how they were involved quite intimately with the English in setting up Germany, et cetera, et cetera. This is straight from her book. Just a rough translation, but this is quite revealing.
Didn't Beck go fly to Britain where he conferred with the British military? And then Hitler found out about Beck being in London in the newspapers.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, little Mr. Two-Face.
Yeah.
Exactly. But we seem to forget all this stuff. And of course, you had mentioned Bullitt, and I want to get to a question that Wilf has for you about that real quick before we start back on Gleiwitz.
Yeah.
Here's what Annelies von Ribbentrop wrote. Marshal Ridge Smigley told Romanian officials after Poland's defeat that Polish units were cut off for 2 days after the start of the war because of German aerial strikes. England had, however, promised Poland the delivery of 1,500 English fighter planes, not one of which arrived. The Western Allies had also assured the Poles that French forces had actually broken through the Siegfried Line in two places and were operating deep in German territory. I mean, what a lie!
Mm-hmm.
This is what they were telling Poland. Oh, yeah, we're invading Germany. You keep it up, guys. So then Ridge Smigley excitedly declared that they had taken that information and promise of help as fact. So this emboldened Poland. The remarks by President Moskiki were especially revealing. He told that Poland had been willing to accept Germany's proposals, but were prevented from doing so by England.
Yes.
And because his ministers had counted on England's assistance, they had allowed war to break out. So that's what she wrote. And then, of course, Wilf asks you, Annelies also writes about Bullitt. Can you ask Deanna what she was referring to?
Well, Bullitt promised U.S. military support and persuaded the Polish officials in Warsaw to negotiate with Hitler. And then they decided for Danzig, okay? And then Beck decided that he would go behind Hitler's back, where he went and conferred with the British military, probably in order to get the same kind of promise from them. And then within a day, the French and Scandinavian newspapers reported that Poland had placed their airspace at the disposal of the Soviet Union, which was an invitation to Stalin. And so it was just, Beck was really going behind Hitler's back after making promises. And the Polish nation's main newspaper, Courier Polski, proclaimed in its headlines, Germany must be destroyed.
There you have it.
So then you
Poland was totally innocent, though.
Yes, of course.
It was all that nasty Führer, and he needed this casus belli known as Gleiwitz.
Right, and this was in August of 1939 that all of this stuff was happening.
Exactly.
And
Hitler supposedly preparing a false flag.
Yes.
It's nonsensical. It really is.
And then, of course, we had on August 31st, 1939, a terrorist in Poland who perpetrated the Bromberg Massacre.
Mm-hmm. Right. And, of course, the British press said that it was all lies. Nothing happened to the German minorities whatsoever. Hitler and the NSDAP invented every single incident. Dozens and dozens of these incidents referred to, not only in the press, but in the White Book and even in foreign press outfits, but they were all invented. I mean, this is the kind of communist Jewish control of the press and the media that makes this, to this day, still what we think.
Right.
It's perception management.
Sure.
That's all it is.
And they did other things, too. The Poles blew up the Dachau Bridge over the Vistula River on August 31st, 1939.
They assassinated some people?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
Forbidden anyone to speak German. You know, if we did that to a minority group in the United States, I guarantee you we'd have international outrage.
Yeah.
But this is how they orchestrate public opinion against their target country. We see the same nonsense against Iran today.
Right. And it was the private newspapers also that were kind of whipping up the Polish terrorist into this frenzied rage. And I mean, they during that Bromberg massacre, they cut off women's breasts and men's testicles. They impaled children with butcher's skewers, slaughtered thousands of innocent German residents.
Mm-hmm.
That was
and there's
before.
Photos of it. I mean, yes. The faces are smashed beyond recognition. Anybody can look up photos of these various massacres.
Right.
You know, that's... It's just, yeah, it's just nonsensical. No, the communists were all about peace and...
Sure.
We just want the proletariat to rule. What nonsense. Okay, so... I'll just start where we left off. I want to mention real quickly our star witnesses here. The first one is Otto Helwig. And this guy was just an absolute bungling fool. According to this After the Battle article, he was ignominiously relieved by Heydrich after he badly botched up during the aborted first attempt of the attack he was in charge of on Hochlinden on the night of August 25th, 26th. So this guy botched his mission so badly he was dismissed. And just when we get to the part about him, I mean, we must believe he was an absolute imbecile who didn't even understand anything. He has Poles attacking Poles, basically. You know, the SS men dressed up as Poles on both sides attacking each other. Doesn't make sense. You might want to have Germans on one side.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know who implicated this man, who said this about him, whether he said it about himself. We'd have to look into any kind of, you know, court testimony. I don't know if this comes from the IMT or if it's a post-war trial in West Germany, but he died in Hanover on August 20th, 1962. So this man clearly was never, quote-unquote, brought to justice for his crimes. That should tell us something.
Oh, absolutely.
Hans Trumler is the next one. This guy was allegedly a unit commander in Einsatzgruppe ZBV, one of the SD mobile killing units employed in the Polish campaign. So here's one of these Einsatzgruppen killers, you know. And this guy is hanged at Landsberg prison, but not for any of that. Not for killing 5 civilians allegedly in Bavaria, not for mass murdering Jews in the Einsatzgruppen genocide, not none of that. He was hanged because he allegedly killed 2 captured American airmen.
Hmm.
So that's very strange. He was hanged in 1948 for killing 2 Allied airmen, had nothing to do with Einsatzgruppe, etc. So that's a little strange. Of course, because he died in 48, we couldn't talk to him.
Well,
he didn't
how
have a chance
handy.
To exonerate himself. Exactly. Otto Rasch is our next star. Let's see, where is his picture? Okay, this guy led the attack by Polish rebels, quote-unquote, on the Pitsian Forestry House. Now, this guy was also a commander of an Einsatzgruppe unit, Einsatzgruppe C, and allegedly was responsible for the murder of no fewer than 80,000 people, 33,771 Jews. I mean, they have such a precise number there. So this is, you know, a man who is guilty of incredible crimes, goes on to become a director of an oil company. No big deal. You know, arrested in 45, prosecuted for war crimes, but released. And he was never brought to trial, allegedly because of Parkinson's disease. Now, he died in 1948, but again, this was from Parkinson's disease. So here's another one where, why weren't you hanged for your alleged war crimes? Did you implicate somebody for this Gleivitz thing so that you could walk free? We have to ask these questions. And our next one is Herbert Mailhorn. Now, we've already gone over the fact that this guy and Heydrich were like arch enemies. And Heydrich had been responsible for his transfer out of the SD to SS postings abroad. Okay, and this guy was stationed in Bratislava in Slovakia at the time of the alleged, you know, Gleivitz incident. So he calls this guy from Slovakia? I don't think so. And then, of course, Mailhorn blew his role. You know, Heydrich allegedly brings him in because he's such an amazing organizer. Just, you know, I'm willing to set aside my extreme hatred of you because you're such a good organizer. And he blew it. Chaotic, foolish bungling. I doubt it. So that doesn't make sense. And this guy died in 1968. And again, after the battle, mentions he was never called to justice for his acts. Well, that's because he told some nice stories to the Allies. And this guy apparently talked to Stern magazine in the 60s before he died. And Stern magazine, I believe that's Jewish run or Jewish controlled, you know, gave some details of Gleivitz that are absolutely absurd. So there you have it. And of course, his account totally conflicts with the affidavits presented at the IMT that were pushed in front of Alfred Naujoks. So whoops, we have two completely different accounts of the same event. Which one of you is lying? It's actually both of them. And then of course, this Kurt Palma, who was allegedly present at the meetings of all these bigwigs, he died in 1945 or vanished. They're not sure what happened to that one. So just wanted to go through our cast of characters real quick because we're getting into what their roles were here. We left off last time on Heydrich, not sure what locations he wanted to attack yet. You know, we're down to the wire, but Heydrich isn't totally sure where he wants to attack yet. So, you know, he calls on Schaefer, Dr. Emanuel Schaefer. Hey, can you tell me where a good place to attack would be around here? And of course, Schaefer, he's worked into the story because he grew up just 2 kilometers from Hochlinden. And so he knew the area very well. Now, Schaefer died in 1974, and he was never implicated for any border crimes or Gleivitz or anything. So he was probably also a star witness. And it was probably extra wonderful that he was familiar with the Hochlinden area because he could give a credible account of this false flag that never happened. Another important person in this story is Neumann, who's the personal adjutant of Heydrich. And I had looked up his fate. I believe he died in 74. I was just on Wikipedia, but I don't actually have it up anymore. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure it was 74. Or actually, no, I take that back. It was 1994. So I think it's Hans Hendrik Neumann, and this was, you know, Heydrich's personal adjutant. Well, the fact that he died in 1994, you know, this is another guy who likely the Allies went to for some nice stories about, yeah, what did your boss do? How horrible he was. Write it all down. Or maybe we'll type it for you and you just sign it, kind of a thing. So he's in the story as well. And he was allegedly, you know, tagging along after Heydrich when they go to meet Schaefer on August 9th. Okay, so on August 9th, Heydrich, Helwig, and Neumann, they fly to Neustadt in a Junkers Ju-52 aircraft. Okay, who documented this? We don't know. We're not told who actually wrote this account or tells us you know, what aircraft they were in, to meet up with Schaefer. The first thing, I mean, as Heydrich is walking off the plane, he tells an astonished Schaefer, "The Fuhrer needs a reason for war." I mean, how idiotic is that? The first thing he says off the plane. So, you know, because you're familiar with this area, Mr. Schaefer, can you help us out? Fuhrer needs a casus belli. I have Neumann was never tried for war crimes and released in 49. So, of course, he's here. Maybe he's the one that gave this account. Next thing, Schaefer, who was also in charge of the district's frontier police. Do we know that? And which district's frontier police? They leave that vague, so we're not sure. You know, the district of Gleiwitz, because the border guard was under Otto Radek. Who's the frontier police? Not sure. I mean, the guy was stationed in Slovakia before, so where they get that, who knows. Basically, Schaefer gives Heydrich the idea that they need to go to two other locations. So they pick the German customs office outside the village of Hochlinden. And the other location is a lone forestry station near the town of Pitzschen. Okay, so basically this has a narrow strip of German territory that extends into Poland in such a way that the German custom house could actually be fired at over Polish land without having to leave Germany. So this little custom house is in a nice location for a false flag, as the Allies can see later. And they go, that would be good to do a story with that. So let's see what else we've got here in this great story. The other one, the forestry office at Pitzschen, again, right on the border, perfect for a false flag incident. You can just go right through the woods. There it is, and, you know, retreat back to the woods. So it seemed credible. Now, the stupidest thing of all is these little kind of silly places, Pitzschen, Hochlinden. I mean, these things are like bumpkin. But Heydrich feels that these three targets will have a wide impact. That doesn't make sense, that some kind of little mini insurgency by Poles, you know, a message of Polish insurrection being broadcast about these things is going to have some wide impact. And I guess Heydrich is figuring, hey, if we have Poles attack these three locations and then announce something over the Gleiwitz transmitter, we're going to convince the world that we're in the right. And that's basically what they're saying his motive is, which is idiotic. I mean, the world was against Hitler already. There was going to be no justification for what he did, no matter how honest they were, or no matter how in the right or justified they were in their actions against Poland. So I'm not really understanding Heydrich's motive here. Of course, this wasn't his motive, so that's why it seems so foolish. And basically, his idea was to have a Polish language radio broadcast from a German radio transmitter violently overrun by Polish terrorists. So that would give the world clear evidence of Polish aggression. But the thing is Gleiwitz was only later thought up, first of all. So this is kind of an afterthought to have this broadcast. Okay, if these other two locations had been the only ones chosen, there wouldn't be any wide impact at all. No one had even heard of Pitzschen or Hochlinden. So, you know, sorry, that was an afterthought on Gleiwitz, first of all. Second of all, how was it going to have a wide impact when it was just a regional transmitter? It broadcast music and German language programming for the people of the Gleiwitz area.
Right. It was a little station. It was,
Exactly. It's certainly not going to have a wide impact. And the thing is it was just a relay station to Breslau. So this station didn't have its own, like, independent broadcast capability. Now, when one takes over the microphone to do something like an emergency weather broadcast to the very local area there, yeah, you're going to be able to do a direct broadcast out to the area, but it's not going to go to Berlin and London, etc.
Or anywhere else. I mean, it was
not anywhere besides the immediate vicinity of Gleiwitz. So that it just doesn't make sense at all. That's an idiotic motive, period. It just wouldn't have happened. And the fact that it was broadcasting music in the German language and programming in the German language, who would understand a Polish broadcast?
Indeed, yes.
I mean, who's going to know what the poll is saying? Is somebody going to translate that for us in the press? It's just idiotic. Okay, so of course, the special task of staging this raid on the Reichsender Gleiwitz was given to SS Sturmbannführer Alfred Naujax. And of course, Naujax is an absolute nobody. This individual had been stricken from the SS lists, dismissed as an SS man for various infractions he had incurred, and he defected to the Allies in October 1944. So this is a real true patriot here in charge of this. And of course, after he bungled the seizure of Otto Strasser's radio transmitter out of Prague, you know, shot somebody, got seen by the hotel personnel, Heydrich was just infuriated with the guy. Do we really believe that Heydrich was going to put him in charge of this false flag that was ultra sensitive? No. So that just, you know, picking him doesn't make any sense. It's because he was the only one that the Allies could drudge up and get the affidavits from. He was willing to sell out, and he pretty much admits that to a couple of historians, which we'll try to get to that today, but we'll see. Now here's another thing. We don't actually know how many men were involved in Naujax's team. It was either 5, 6, or 7. And of course, his broadcaster, the guy who speaks Polish, he only arrived like at the last minute, basically. Oh, thank goodness you're in time, man. We're cutting it short, buddy. You know, and then they cruise over there and take care of the situation and start this false flag. That's just the stupidest planning. I don't think so. And then was that guy who's never been named, the guy who allegedly spoke the Polish insurrectionary speech, he has no name. Is he the one that wrote the speech? Did Heydrich write the speech for him? No. He allegedly wrote the speech on his own. It was kind of this impromptu thing thrown together by that team. Are we really believing that Hitler or Heydrich would allow these subordinates to write the proclamation?
I don't think so.
Oh, that's idiotic, especially if you're going to use it for propaganda. You want it to be very carefully worded, and you want it to be realistic. You don't want it to sound like it's written by a buffoon who's lying. So, you know, I don't buy that either. And this is a really cute detail. Naujax was not to get in touch with or inform any official authority in the town of Gleiwitz, and his men should not carry anything that could identify them as belonging to the SS-SD police or show their German nationality. So we have no way of verifying that any SS men, any SD men, any policemen, no one were there, because they never were allowed to talk or show any identity. This is something we cannot verify because of this stupid detail. Now, there would be some kind of documentation in the German archives designating who was taking part. We know how meticulous the Germans were. Heydrich would have wanted an accounting of every individual involved, because he would have come killed anybody who talked, okay, about a false flag if this was serious and these people were really as criminal and mendacious as they're being portrayed to be. There's no way he would have been just like, oh yeah, who's involved again? No. And then no way of, you know, there's just absolutely no way we can prove this even occurred. And it's not for no reason that when the German authorities went to prosecute those involved in this alleged false flag, they couldn't find any culprits. Well, duh, they didn't exist.
Right.
They didn't exist. And this is why Naujax had to say stupid things like this. Oh, yeah, we had to speak Polish all the time and have no idea, etc., etc. And here's another quaint detail. Heydrich wasn't going to send him anything. He was going to telephone I'll call you on the phone with the order. And of course, it was grandmother died. So I'll call ya. Grandmother died. Okay, you'll know that that's the key. You need to start the false flag so that we have no paper trail. Everything was oral. And there's all kinds of motorcycle dispatchers in this story. No names, no ranks, no idea who these people are. They're the ones that relayed all these orders, and none of them thought to maybe keep one of those, you know, orders, right, one of those pieces of paper, anything. None of these people came forward in the post-war trials. Now, there were no motorcycle dispatchers. None of these people existed. And so that's why there's no names. Now Yox was allegedly given the authority to personally select four people from his own SD unit. No, wouldn't have happened, especially not after his bungling in Prague. And Heydrich went ahead and assigned the other two. Why would you do that? Why would you have one guy do four and then Heydrich assigns two? That doesn't make any sense. And then, of course, when the post-war German authorities tried to find out who these four men were, and then Heydrich's other two, didn't exist, couldn't find anybody to pin the crime on. And then, of course, one of these people was a radio expert from Radio Berlin. Name? Name? Okay. Who's this employee that worked at Radio Berlin? No, we don't get one. And then the other, an announcer who spoke Polish. Who was that? No name. And then this is cute. This latter man who spoke Polish, a Polish bank clerk and Gestapo informer from Opeln, actually did not join the team until later, arriving only an hour before the actual raid.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
Right. Okay, he's allegedly, they give you the details, he was a Gestapo informer from Opeln, bank clerk.
Doesn't make
name, sense. Name, rank, anything at all. Nope, you don't get anything from this guy. On August 12th, Naujax and his band of five, okay, I thought it was six, but now it's five, motored to Gliwice in two cars and took up residence in the Haus Oberschlesien and the other hotel, which we don't get a name of. So one other hotel and then this Haus Oberschlesien. Now, I asked the question, did anyone at this Haus Oberschlesien confirm this? Did they say yes, there was a group of potentially suspicious Polish-speaking people or whatever? Just, or there was a group that stayed for 2 weeks. Yes. It was a little strange. There were 300 of them or whatever, 130. Somebody would have noticed this. No. No hotel people. No innkeepers. Nobody. Nobody came forward to say this ever occurred at this hotel. So that's another idiotic thing. Now, supposedly, Naujax's group registered under false identifications under the pretense of engineers and geologists. Again, does the hotel register have anything about that? Were there any eyewitnesses who took down that information? Nope, not a word from any personnel at this hotel. So again, it's because it was invented.
Right. No corroborating evidence or eyewitness testimony, nothing.
Right. So the personnel at this place never questioned. There's no records of guests that were ever checked for the IMT. You know, it's crazy. If you or I were brought to trial and this, you know, we were being accused of such a crime, we would certainly want some kind of witness of this crime we're being alleged of committing. I mean, this is just the biggest travesty of justice here. It's really idiotic what happened at that IMT. And, you know, many of the NS officials defended themselves well because I think they knew, you know.
Oh, they knew they were being
set up. If I don't just make my statement, I'm going down anyway, so.
Yep.
Right. It's just crazy. So here's another thing. At this meeting of August 11th, Heydrich convened planning conference with his four commanders. People should really ask, where was Heydrich on August 11th, 1939? Could he have even arranged this meeting with four Tannenberg commanders? They don't give us a location, but a German person or somebody really familiar with documentation should ask, where was he? Because if he was like in Berlin or something, or had a meeting with Hitler that day or Himmler, we know for a fact this meeting didn't take place. So people need to start looking into the minute details.
Right. Which of is course, what you do very well. And it's those minute details that actually reveal what actually went on or didn't go on.
Right. Yeah, it's very important to get into where these people were on these certain days. Mailhorn supposedly raises more questions at this meeting. I really seriously doubt Mailhorn would be questioning Heydrich at a meeting.
Oh, absolutely.
You're a fool if you think this is going to go over. Okay, so, which he apparently presented to Heydrich in writing. Here you go. Hands him a written letter. I think stupid. But Heydrich was quick to extinguish all of Mailhorn's magnanimous doubts by declaring the operation a Führerbefehl, Hitler order. Okay? I won't hear any objections. This is straight from the Führer. Okay? No, it wasn't. And this guy who wrote this essay didn't realize that at the beginning of the essay, he wrote that Heydrich and Himmler had the idea of border false flag incidents, suggested it to Hitler, who then agreed that it was a good idea. It's not a Führer order. Hitler merely agreed with Heydrich and Himmler's idea. So this is not a Hitler order. This is a Heydrich order. Absolutely nonsensical. Mailhorn completely invented that off the top of his head.
Sure. And it was something that Germany had never done before, but that another group of people do all the time and continue to do it to this day.
Right. Exactly. Yep. And the original reconnaissance team that's, you know, set up to survey this whole thing, et cetera, et cetera. Naujax wasn't even part of this. He wasn't part of the initial think tank, not the reconnaissance group, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they send him in there, and he does a last second reconnaissance right before he enters the building as a street hawker.
So he says,
mm-hmm. In the building. Okay, he'd never even been in the building and knew his way around. Just, I know exactly where to go. There's the microphone. You know what I mean? No, didn't happen. Did not happen. Okay, so what else do I have? Okay, here's another thing. Hals Oberschlesien. So these guys all, you know, it ends up being over 100 of these people. Large, large groups. Took up residence smack dab in the center of Gleiwitz with no ID. Same thing in Hochlinden and Pitschen. No ID, just, you know, take over a hotel, close it down for 2 weeks. No one says anything. No one notices anything. Gee, this hotel's shut down for 2 weeks, completely under lock and key. Nope, nothing. No one, you know, mentioned a peep about any of this. And here's this doesn't make sense to me. So these guys at their meeting, where Heydrich supposedly says it's a Führer order, they want to stage 3 border incidents. Why 3? I don't know. Is it a Masonic number? Could be.
Yeah.
Okay. Polish army soldiers and insurgents against the German custom house at Hochlinden, an attack by Polish insurgents on the Pitschen forestry station, and a raid by Polish rebels on the German radio station at Gleiwitz. Why wouldn't you just have them all the same? Why is one going to be army combined with insurgents? And would the Poles even do that? Would the Polish military attack something and have it, you know, detached insurgents right alongside them? Would Polish rebels, and I mean, what does that mean, Polish rebel? Is that a civilian who's kind of taken the law into his own hands and I'm going to go take down those Germans? I mean, was this even credible? Either from the German or Polish side or even to an outsider. It reminds me of the Holy Jihadist Brigades. Now, many people have probably not heard of them because they don't really exist. But they were the group who allegedly took Steve Centani prisoner to get him out of Palestine so that he would not report on the anti-Arab atrocities there being committed by Israelis. So what I believe Mossad did, or some Jewish group, is they posed as the quote-unquote holy jihadist brigades to get those CNN reporters out of there.
Sure.
That happened recently. Now, can anyone tell us who the holy jihadist brigades are? That's the kind of thing this is like. And when the Polish speaker actually goes to announce who they are, you'll see why it just totally reeks of the same thing. He basically identifies himself as something like the Polish Volunteer Corps, some ridiculous thing that didn't even exist. So, you know, this is how they do it. This is the kind of nonsense they pull. So we need to be thinking about that. Insurgents. Well, what insurgents? Who would that even be on the Polish side? And then, of course, the whole intent of this was that this mock attack at Hochlinden would draw the attention of the Polish frontier troops. And so it was hoped even lure Polish soldiers across the border into Germany, allowing the Germans to take real Polish prisoners. That not only didn't happen, but that would have been totally idiotic. I mean, people would have known that that was nonsense.
Right.
You know, any investigation into that, they would have said, excuse me, what unit was this of the Wehrmacht? Who was in this engagement where the Poles came across the border? And the Germans would have been like, you know, they wouldn't have had an explanation. You have to have an accounting for who's attacking another country, unless it's completely covert in the case of like the CIA, where they're in a country and, you know, it's not an actual de facto military affair where you're using the U.S. Army. But in this case, they actually wanted the Polish army to come across the border and be confronted with the Wehrmacht, the German army. So, you know, the army would have gone, who engaged these people? It's just nonsensical.
Right.
Would have been an investigation into that.
And
so
I'm sorry, didn't mean to interrupt. But, you know, it's also interesting that all of the things that were going on in America and in Britain at the time, they started preparing for war in 1936. They were starting to build all kinds of different bombs. In 1936, Roosevelt sent William C. Bullitt to France as ambassador. And so he's basically over there just nosing around, seeing what's going on. Mm-hmm. And Bullitt recommended that Roosevelt break the Neutrality Act, repeal the Neutrality Act, over the situation with Bohemia and Moravia. And then Bullitt, getting back to Bullitt again, on March 16th, Bullitt suggested that Roosevelt give Chamberlain a strong ultimatum that the British government adamantly opposed Germany. Otherwise, the U.S. would discontinue their material and moral support. And so, I mean, I think that's very important. And then, within a couple of weeks, the British decided that they would go along with it. And what the Americans would do was that they would ship airplanes and materials like that to Britain, and then Britain would supply Poland, and that's how the hat was supposed to go down. And that was arranged early in 1939, in around March or April.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a long road of orchestration. It just makes the whole Gleiwitz thing that much more senseless. And of course, nobody to this day knows how the Breslau station announced any kind of raid or deaths occurring at the Gleiwitz transmission station. Now, there was Otto Radek and one other individual tried to look into it, but Radek got sick. He just couldn't continue his studies into this. But this is something that New Age historians need to start looking into. Unfortunately, it's got to be somebody who speaks German and reads it well. and, you know, has better access to this information. I'm sure there's still a lot of stuff floating around in the IFZ, etc. And of course, also preferably on the Polish side. The fact that the Poles didn't make anything out of the Gliwice incident at all should tell us that nothing happened there. Right. Otherwise, the Poles would have had a field day with their propaganda.
Of course.
Why didn't they?
Of course. The fact that it didn't come out until after the war.
Exactly.
And until people had had actually, you know, come forward and said, oh, yeah, I was there and I did this and I was in charge of that.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Somebody would have said something. And I mean, again, if the Poles knew that they were innocent and something had actually happened, they would have said, no way that Germany did this. And it would have been obvious to anyone on the outside. So, yeah, it's just foolish. Of course, the overall coordination of this thing would be in the hands of Mailhorn. How convenient. Mm-hmm. The guy who gets fired and lives on to 1968 and has never tried so that he could, you know, kind of describe the whole thing and be the leader, if you will. And for some reason, his command post was to be installed in Schaefer's Gestapo headquarters at Oppeln. Why Mailhorn gets authority to go into Schaefer's Gestapo headquarters? Again, this is remnant of the idea that we can just trounce on each other's authority. You know, one Gestapo man is as good as another kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter what your SS rank is. You can tell other SS men what to do. No, that's not how it worked. Let's see. Oh, this is great, too. Allegedly, there were all these telephone lines to forward stations closer to the assault areas, etc. Well, what phone lines were those? You know, that's something people need to look into. Was this even established? Was this possible? Were there telephone connections to such and such from here and there?
Exactly.
You know, I doubt it. They mention for Hochlinden, this was the police station at Grossrauden. Now, is this true? Was there a phone line from Grossrauden to Hochlinden that they could have utilized at that time to get this, you know, this information passed, to get this communication through?
Right, because this was, after all, 1939. And we're talking about some remote areas.
Exactly. And, I mean, no one saw them put up these telephone lines. Were they already there? I mean, these are the kind of questions that no one asks. You know, and Hochlinden is very remote, definitely, on that one. Radios wouldn't be used. Can't have that. All coded commands were to be issued orally by telephone and by Heydrich personally. So everything comes back to Heydrich, which we cannot verify because he died. He was shot by our precious little Czech assassins. So, you know, that's just a little too convenient.
You know, it's kind of amazing. In speaking about telephones, some of the people on 9/11 up in the plains, they claim to have gotten telephone calls, and they were above, way above the 5,000 foot elevation, where it was impossible to receive telephone calls, and yet nobody really even questioned this for quite some time.
Right. Yep. Well, we don't think about things.
Right.
We're just kind of told this story by the media, and we go, oh, well, they must know.
Sure.
The media. No, they must not know, and you must question everything they say.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Here's another thing. Okay, so when these people move to their forward bases, they're like, oh, wait, when the assault teams are actually at their forward bases, we have no way of talking to them because of telephone lines. Oh, shoot. We'll use motorcycle dispatch riders. Who were they? Okay, so this is an afterthought. They're going, oh, okay, that's how we'll solve it. So didn't even think about this until the last minute. And then none of them are named. Who were these people? Okay, no, didn't happen. So here's another thing. Heydrich is realizing, well after the fact, oh, wait, we need Polish army uniforms and equipment to make this look real. I got to dress up my SS men. Well, he goes to Canaris. Admiral Canaris and the which had a store, allegedly a store of Polish equipment taken from Polish deserters. Now,
from where?
That's kind of interesting because, okay, yes, from where, number one, who were these Polish deserters? What unit were they? Who were they? Okay, they don't tell us that, but let's pretend it's true. Canaris was an anti-Hitler traitor and had been doing sabotage work via the Abwehr for years, and so did Hans Oster and many other Gestapo and Abwehr people. There were numerous traitors in the Abwehr and the Gestapo both. Okay, so Abwehr's compromised. Canaris, totally compromised. Is Heydrich A. going to trust this man when he had been following him, trailing him very closely for quite some time? Heydrich had a case file on Canaris and had been watching him for quite a while. And right before he was shot, I'm talking literally down to the week or 2 weeks before, he was ready to arrest Canaris on charges of treachery and traitorousness.
And he was working with the British.
Exactly. So in 1939, I think we can count on Canaris already being compromised, already playing some games.
Oh, of course.
So,
because he was part of the old school.
Part
of the old elite.
Sure. Yeah. And if he did indeed have this Polish equipment and did, in fact, have the Abwehr play some kind of role in anything like this, that's where we need to start looking. The Abwehr. Would Canaris have done something to set up the SS? It's possible. Okay, so this is something that somebody would need to look into. I'll get to exactly what that is. There's something that the Abwehr was accused of. Where is that? I'm going to have to wait until we get to it. Oh, here it is. Here it is. Okay, so basically what happens is his guys bungle it. Heydrich's guys bungle it. They go in too soon because the Führer isn't yet sure he wants to go to war, and they jumped the gun with their false flag and went in before Hitler had actually declared war. Whoops. Okay, so Heydrich was equally furious with Abwehr chief Canaris for the inquiry into the botch-up had produced another quite unsuspected piece of news. Border guards at Hochlinden had reported that on the night of August 24th, 25th, one night before the failed action, a group of ethnic Germans had crossed the border and destroyed the Polish customs office at Chwalisice with hand grenades. This made one part of Heydrich's plan to have part of the Polish force capture the Polish custom house and use its telephone to alert the Polish frontier troops impossible. Interrogated by the police, one of the participants stated that they had acted on orders of the Abwehr, leading Heydrich to suspect that Canaris, resentful of his reduced role, had tried to sabotage the SD's frontier action. Now, the involvement of the Abwehr in the destruction of the Polish border station could never be proven, and it seems certain that it had nothing to do with it, according to this author. And he concludes, in all probability, he's not sure, the foray was an impromptu action by local NS or German activists. That's something we need to look into for sure. Did the Abwehr really do that? Because if they did, that would explain a lot of things. Why the British were reporting on incidents happening in Hochlinden before they had actually taken place, and they would know because Canaris would have fed him the information because he was behind it.
Sure.
And this would also definitely make Canaris completely out of any kind of false flag. I mean, Heydrich would have balked right then and there. I'm just not buying it. And we're supposed to believe that Canaris was involved, intimately involved in this, and was providing the Polish uniforms to the SD. The SD couldn't get its own Polish uniforms? I doubt it. I think they had to weave Canaris into this story. Mm-hmm. So here's one of these stupid details. Heydrich was unwilling to appeal directly to his rival Canaris, his rival, we all know that. Mm-hmm. So he asked Himmler to do it. Can you ask him to give me the Polish uniforms, Mr. Himmler? That's just the kind of idiocy. So I put very odd. Heydrich would have asked, he would have asked directly, whatever, to have an order, asks Himmler to have an order issued to the Abwehr by Hitler himself. Heydrich would have gone to Hitler and told him, hey, I need you to tell Canaris to give me, or whatever. But
Right.
that doesn't even make sense. No. And why you have the Abwehr and the SD working together? Not sure about that. One is state secret, like state police, if you will. State security is more like it. Homeland security, if you will. And the other one is military police, or military intelligence. Why would they be working together? Like, I don't know about this. This is just silly.
Yes. And of course, England at the time, they were preparing for war, and they also started with their attempts to encircle Germany, and they were coming up with all kinds of lies and saying, oh, Germany is threatening other people and they're going to go after all of their neighbors. Doesn't that sound like some of the same stuff that we hear today in the newspapers? Oh, we've
Oh,
got to
yeah.
go after Iran because look, they're threatening and everything. And so, of course, they would have the motivation. The Brits would have the motivation to do a false flag, to arrange a false flag, to lie about a false flag after the fact at the tribunal. So, it's, this is just the way that they operate.
Yeah, and this is allegedly the Abwehr's only involvement. Now, the interesting thing is Canaris allegedly tried to get out of this order by complaining to Wilhelm Keitel. And then Keitel says, well, I can't do anything about it. It's a Führer order. It was? I mean, I thought Heydrich asked Himmler to get these uniforms, and then Himmler would have then asked Hitler, that isn't a Führer order.
Right.
Okay, you see, they're convoluting it again.
Yeah.
And then Heydrich's own foreign intelligence service, led by SS Brigadeführer Heinz Jost, passed them on to the Tannenberg commanders, these uniforms. Okay, the problem is Heinz Jost was never brought to trial either. He was never implicated for war crimes. So, was he the source of this information? This part of the story? This is, after all, the Abwehr's only involvement in this entire affair. Why involve them at all? You're really going to take a chance involving the Abwehr, military intelligence, by asking them to give you uniforms, Polish uniforms, potentially leaking this whole thing when you suspect that Canaris could be a traitor and tell the world about Polish uniforms. I don't think so. That's their only involvement? That just doesn't make any sense. And then, of course, there's another problem. The whole training of these people. Allegedly, they went through drills and training. I don't know why you have to do drills and training for a quick false flag that lasts like 17 minutes or
Exactly.
4 minutes or whatever. And besides, if the SD had its own schools, why was the Gestapo involved at all? Why would you use their schools in
Right.
addition to your own? That doesn't make sense. So again, they're convoluting Gestapo and SD. Homeland Security and secret state police, basically.
Right.
No, ain't gonna happen. So I just put SD only. I mean, that just, it doesn't make sense. And here's another thing. The recruitment of these Tannenberg personnel was allegedly now underway. They wait halfway into the month, okay, to even call these people up and get this going to start their intensive drill training. Okay, so whatever that's supposed to be. But they'd receive a call-up telegram from maybe the Gestapo, maybe the police, or maybe the Sicherheitsdienst. We're not
Right.
sure. Could be any one of them. No. No. Doesn't make sense.
Nope.
You're not going to get three different agencies summoning these people. Just ain't going to happen. And then, of course, one of the people who ran one of these SS, or was this a, yeah, this is a SS school. It's just an SS officer fencing school. Okay. We're going to use that. Was Karl Hoffmann. And this is possibly Karl Heinz Hoffman. We went over his IMD testimony, etc. Well, this guy, you know, he was never brought to trial, etc., for crimes. So how come that's not an issue? We don't know what his fate was. There is nothing on Carl Hoffman, SS Sturmbannführer Carl Hoffman. So, you know, nobody knows. Carl Heinz Hoffman, if it's the same man, was never brought to trial for anything. So I don't know how he skated, because he became involved. And the funny thing is he's asked at one of the beer evenings, Helvig, one of the Tannenberg commanders here, he asks him, you know, while they're drinking booze, would you like to be in this upcoming operation, Mr. Hoffman? I think you'd make a great trooper. I mean, what? Asks him if he'd like to come along. It's just this kind of idiocy.
You know, it's very common that people who participate in false flags never come to trial.
Uh-huh.
When you look at every false flag, you know, for the last 100 or so years,
right,
all of these people just go on with their lives, and nobody ever gets fired, questioned, or anything else. So why should it be any different this time?
Exactly.
So this is the way that they spun it after the war, and so what if they blame a couple people? You know,
right.
Six people or seven people. Nothing's ever going to happen to them anyway, because they were working for the winners.
Exactly. Yep. I mean, these people obviously sold out.
Yes.
At what point, we don't know. I mean, I think Canaris was, there's just so much evidence against that individual. He had a much earlier role than most of the IMT people, but, you know, we don't know if they were working for the Allies before.
Sure.
Setting up certain things. So yeah, we have to be really careful about how we trust these people's testimony. And then of course, you know, the author's saying in mid-August, Trumler and Helvig paid an unannounced visit to the school. When
how
was mid-August?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Can we get a date, Mr. Whitehead? And then of course, an unannounced visit to the school. That's not possible. That swastika and scimitar written by Franz Wimmer Lomkvist, he had his own school called Kloster. It was so well guarded, no one could get anywhere near his school without proper identification, expected visitation, etc. Very serious security, especially when there's war on the horizon. So I'm not buying that these people just paid an unannounced visit to the school.
Right.
Go ahead.
Because there were so many things going on. I mean, there were sorties. The Polish were flying sorties into German territory. I think they did at least like 35 before August 31st. I mean, there were a lot of things going on that,
right.
You know, they just wouldn't have done that. Security
sure.
would have been very, very intense.
Right. And, of course, the following day, I mean, they tell us mid-August, and then the following day,
yeah, right.
You messed up on that one, Mr. Whitehead. Heydrich's chief adjutant phoned Hoffman. Who the chief adjutant is, I guess we need to assume it's Neumann. He allegedly phoned Hoffman to inform him that his school was selected, and he would need to be prepared all of a sudden for a top-secret SS operation for 120 to 250 men. We're not quite sure how many. I mean, that's a discrepancy of like 100 people.
Right.
Expect, you know, at least 120, maybe almost 300. No. And if that's coming from Neumann, that makes sense. Sold out to the Allies, told them what they needed to hear. Of course, the first recruits arrived at Bernau on August 16th, so we're told. I guess that's mid-August.
Mm-hmm.
Driven there in closed trucks. Their number quickly grew to some 364 men. Why? Didn't he just tell him to expect 120 to 250? And now, for some reason, we have 364? They had to sever all connections with the Reich. Okay, well, how do we know their story then? Who gives us this account of them being traveling in closed trucks, etc.?
Right.
They were required to sign secrecy pacts under threat of death.
And where are those?
Family members. We'll put your family in jail if you say anything. Okay, that's what kind of nonsense we're told. None were allowed to carry any personal effects. You can't even have a comb. Okay, these people can't have anything on them. All mail was censored, and only a cover address, Potter and Mühl, Berlin, could be used. None of this can be verified because allegedly it's all super secret and there's no paper trail for anything.
Well, you know how wonderful the Germans are about all those codes and all those things that they can do in secret.
And they're bringing 364 men in closed trucks.
Right.
Who did they get the trucks from? Who gave them the authority? You know, did anyone see this? This is a kind of idiocy. I mean, you don't just come up with trucks. You got to go to the Volkswagen factory or something and get these things.
But
they
don't give you
any of these details.
A story that is repeated and repeated and repeated without anybody ever asking about the details, pretty soon people just believe it without even thinking about, okay, well, tell us exactly what happened. We always hear about the Gleiwitz incident and mm-hmm. Kristallnacht. But let's get down to the details, as you have done. And we find out that, there's a lot of unanswered questions and a lot of supposed things that happened that there's absolutely no evidence regarding it. It just mm-hmm. doesn't add up.
Right. Yeah. And, of course, I'll just do this last part and then we'll stop for today. Allegedly on August 19th, two trucks loaded with the 150 Polish uniforms and equipment from Canaris arrived. Would it take two trucks for just 150 Polish uniforms? I don't, that's not that many people. They're folded neatly and stacked. I'm sure 150 pants and shirts could fit in one truck. Okay.
Or less.
Right. Okay, and then about 40 of the men received a kit bag containing a uniform and accoutrements and were issued with Polish Army carbines from the First World War. Okay, was Poland really that backward? They hadn't progressed since World War I? I mean, I don't know if I buy that. A little strange. Behind the times. They all allegedly got a Polish-style crew cut. The NCOs grew beards and whiskers, which were commonplace in the Polish army. Was it? Can any Poles verify this? I'd like a Polish person to tell me whether or not NCOs and officers had beards and whiskers in the Polish army at that time. Let's find out. Might as well do a little fact check on them. Okay, and several of these recruits, who are all unnamed, of course, these are Germans now, had actually served in the Polish army. And so they knew how to do Polish army drill and they knew the regulations, etc. So they could really make this look realistic. Who were these people? Who were these NCOs? I want some names. If they're going to be accused of this, I want names. And then, of course, the remaining men were to act as part of the Polish insurgents. Again, you know, what insurgents are we even talking about? Were these communist Poles? Were they just civilian Poles? We don't know. And they were going to be put in rogue clothing. I don't know what that means. Just black boot trousers, typical Polish civilian jackets and caps, and some cigarettes, matches, letters, and bills. Here's some Polish money. Put that in your pocket. Just idiotic.
It is.
And then the whole group would spend evenings rehearsing and singing Polish songs. Why? Are you going to sing on your way? Yes, they actually say that. They sang and yelled in Polish as they advanced on the custom house. Who does that? I mean, this is actually a very amusing article. I can't believe anyone can read this in a real serious historian and not laugh and go, this just can't be. Okay. But none of the men knew their mission. They didn't know what they were even going to do. They just learning Polish and drinking beer and singing. And yeah, it's some SS mission. We're not sure what it is. But this is the best part of all. they were made aware that it was of the highest order. This is super important. I mean, what?
Oh, my goodness.
That's about it. I'm just going to start laughing like crazy. They thought of them. They thought themselves as a suicide squad.
And that's why they were singing, right?
Yes. So we'll stop there because it's just, I'm starting to lose it. But it's like, you guys really, they didn't know their mission, but they thought, oh, this is straight from the fear of the highest authority. I think this is some kind of suicide mission. Why would they think that? It just, it makes for a great fiction novel, I'll tell you. But
yes, novel, absolutely.
Yeah.
Truth, no.
Right. And of course, we'll have this finished up next time. And, you know, I did notice that the model of Gleiwitz, the station that's allegedly, mm-hmm. it was Heydrich's pet, that he'd show everyone, oh, look at this model. This is how the war started. And it had real working electricity, etc. That model, we don't know actually existed. It existed in the movie made in the 1960s by the East German government. Okay, they made that model. We don't know if an actual model really existed.
I wouldn't think so.
I wouldn't think so either. Why would they need a model made? I want a big plastic model made. Why? So that you could see how it went down? I don't think so. So, just idiots like that. And of course, hopefully I'll have the white book. It's been a month since I ordered it, but those orders from Germany to the U.S. take a while.
Oh my, that is well.
Customs. I think it's our customs that's so slow.
Right. They want to make sure that you're not getting some sort of devious information or some sort of...
Oh yeah, they're probably watching my mail. This is going to that clerk again. So, and then of course we'll go over just the idiocies that were exposed in Der Große Wendig. That's that little revisionist thing written in German.
Okay.
So, yeah, we'll go through all those.
All righty.
It's time.
All righty. Well, we'll talk next week, Ben.
And all right.
Thank you so
much. It's been fun.
It has been fun. Who would have thought we'd be laughing? But
I know it does. That article does get amusing. I
ridiculous.
It's hard to keep it together on stuff like this. All righty.
Okay. Take care.
Okay. You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.